and a claw, and a claw. Shout out the horses, on up the horses, and a claw.
Fredonia's gone to war. Each native son will grab a gun and run away to war.
At last the country's gone to war.
At last the country's gone to war.
This is a fact we can't ignore.
In case you haven't heard before, I think they think we're going to war. I think they think we're going to war.
We're going to war.
I think they think we're going to war.
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 Yep, and as the Marx brothers say, at last we're going to war. But enough of that. We're not going to talk about that tonight. We're going to talk about jokes, humor, and never the twain shall meet. Well, I don't know about you, but I've never met Mark Twain, but I've read his stuff. And all I can say is, recently, a teacher, a garbage collector, and a lawyer wound up together at the pearly gates. St. Peter informed them that in order to get to heaven, they would each have to answer one question. St. Peter addressed the teacher and asked, what was the name of the ship that crashed into the iceberg? They just made a movie about it. The teacher answered quickly, well, that would be the Titanic. St. Peter led him through the gate. St. Peter turned to the garbage man, figuring that heaven didn't really need all the odors that this guy would bring with him, and decided to make the question a little harder. How many people died on the ship? Fortunately for him, the trash man had just seen the movie. 1228, he answered. That's right, he said. You may enter. Then Peter turned to the lawyer and said, okay, name them. Entering into Heaven, Part 2. A man arrives at the gate of heaven, St. Peter asks. Religion? The man said. Methodist. St. Peter looks down his list. Go to room 24, but be very quiet as you pass room 8. Another man arrives at the gate. Religion? St. Peter asks. Baptist, he said. Go to room 18, but be very quiet as you pass room 8. The third man arrives at the gate. St. Peter turns to him and says, religion? Jewish, the man responds. Go to room 11, but be very quiet as you pass room 8. The man said, now I can understand there being different rooms for different religions, but why must I be quiet when I pass room 8? St. Peter turns to him and says, well, the Jehovah Witnesses are in room 8, and they think they're the only ones here. Another joke you might want to hear is, how do elephants communicate? They talk on the elephone. Who weighs 600 pounds and wears glass slippers? A cinder elephant. What's big and gray and can fly straight up? Oh, come on, you can guess. An helicopter. Okay. Three buddies die in a crash. They go to heaven to an orientation. They're all asked, when you're in your casket and the friends and family are mourning upon you, what would you like them to say about you? Well, the first guy says, well, I'd like to hear them say that I was a great doctor of my time, a great family man. The second guy says, well, I'd like to hear that I was a wonderful husband and school teacher, which made a huge difference in our children's tomorrow. The last guy says, I'd like to hear them say, look, look, he's moving. Gates gets the punishment. Bill Gates suddenly dies and finds himself face to face with God. God stood over Bill Gates and said, well, Bill, I'm really confused on this one. It's a tough decision. I'm not sure whether to send you to heaven or hell. After all, you help society enormously by putting a computer in almost every home in America, and yet you created that ghastly Windows 95 among other indiscretions. I believe I'll say something I've never done before. I'll let you decide where you want to go. Well, Bill pushed up his glasses, looked up at God, and said, well, could you briefly explain the difference between the two? Looking slightly puzzled, God says, well, better yet, why don't I let you visit both places briefly, and then you can make your decision? Which do you want to see first, heaven or hell? Bill played with his pocket protector for a moment, looked back at God, and said, hey, I think I'll try hell first. So with a flash of lightning and a cloud of smoke, Bill Gates went to hell. When he materialized in hell, Bill looked around. It was beautiful and clean, a bit warm, with sandy beaches, tall mountains, clear skies, pristine water, beautiful women frolicking about. A smile came across Bill's face as he took in the deep breath of the clean air. This is great, he thought. If this is hell, I can't wait to see heaven. Within seconds of his thought, another flash of lightning and cloud of smoke appeared, and Bill was off to heaven. Heaven was a place high above the clouds where angels were drifting about, playing their harps, singing in beautiful chorus. It was a very nice place. So how's everything going? God asked. Time passed, and God decided to check on the late billionaire to see how he was progressing in hell. When he got there, he found Bill Gates shackled to a wall in a dark cave and amid bone-thin men and tongues of fire being burned and tortured by demons. So how's everything going? God asked. Bill responded with a crackling voice filled with anguish and disappointment. This is awful. It's nothing like the hell I visited the first time. I can't believe this is happening. What happened to the other place, the beaches, the mountains, the beautiful women? Oh, that was the demo, said God. Okay, let's see here. My goodness. What weighs 6,000 pounds and wears glass slippers? A Cinderella elephant. How can you tell if there's an elephant in your refrigerator? Look for footprints in the cheesecake. How can you tell if there's three elephants in your refrigerator? The door won't close. And now I want to bring you one of the excerpts of Twain. This is an excerpt called Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven. It's about a 19th century sea captain who heads off into the great beyond. And here it is, without any further ado, Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven.
Chapter 1 of Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven by Mark Twain. Chapter 1. Reading by Kevin Laverne. Well, when I had been dead about 30 years, I began to get a little anxious. Mind you, had been whizzing through space all that time like a comet. Like a comet. Why, Peters, I laid over the lot of them. Of course, there weren't any of them going my way, as a steady thing, you know, because they travel in a long circle like the loop of a lasso, whereas I was pointed as straight as a dart for the hereafter. But I happened on one every now and then that was going my way for an hour or so, and then we had a bit of a brush together. But it was generally pretty one-sided, because I sailed by them the same as if they were standing still. An ordinary comet don't make more than about 200,000 miles a minute. Of course, when I came across one of that sort, like Encke's and Halley's comets, for instance, It weren't anything but just a flash and a vanish, you see. You couldn't rightly call it a race. It was as if the comet was a gravel train and I was a telegraph dispatch. But after I got outside our astronomical system, I used to flush a comet occasionally that was something like. We haven't got any such comets. Ours don't begin. One night, I was swinging along at a good round gait, everything taut and trim, and the wind in my favor. I judged I was going about 1,000,000 miles a minute. It might have been more. It couldn't have been less. When I flushed a most uncommonly big one about 3 points off my starboard bow. By his stern lights, I judged he was bearing about northeast and by north half east. Well, it was so near my course that I wouldn't throw away the chance, so I fell off a point, steadied my helm, and went for him. You should have heard me whiz and seen the electric fur fly. In about 1.5 minutes, I was fringed out with an electrical nimbus that flamed around for miles and miles and lit up all space like broad day. The comet was burning blue in the distance, like a sickly torch, when I first sighted him, but he began to grow bigger and bigger as I crept up on him. I slipped up on him so fast that when I had gone about 150,000,000 miles, I was close enough to be swallowed up in the phosphorescent glory of his wake, and I couldn't see anything for the glare. Thinks I, it won't do to run into him, so I shunted to one side and tore along. By and by, I closed up abreast of his tail. Do you know what it was like? It was like a gnat closing up on the continent of America. I forged along. By and by, I had sailed along his coast for a little upwards of 150,000,000 miles, and then I could see by the shape of him that I hadn't even got up to his waistband yet. Why, Peters, we don't know anything about comets down here. If you want to see comets that are comets, you've got to go outside of our solar system, where there's room for them, you understand? My friend, I've seen comets out there that couldn't even lay down inside the orbits of our noblest comets without their tails hanging over. Well, I boomed along another 150,000,000 miles and got up abreast his shoulder, as you may say. I was feeling pretty fine, I tell you, but just then I noticed the officer of the deck come to the side and hoist his glass in my direction. Straight off, I heard him sing out, "Below there, ahoy! Shake her up, shake her up! Heave on 100,000,000,000,000 tons of brimstone!" "Aye, aye, sir." "Pipe the starboard watch. All hands on deck." "Aye, aye, sir." "Send 200,000,000,000 men aloft to shake out royals and skyscrapers." "Aye, aye, sir." "Hand the stunsails. Hang out every rag you've got. Clothe her from stem to rudder post." "Aye, aye, sir." In about a second, I begun to see I'd woke up a pretty ugly customer, Peters. In less than 10 seconds, that comet was just a blazing cloud of red-hot canvas. It was piled up into the heavens clean out of sight. The old thing seemed to swell out and occupy all space. The sulfur smoke from the furnaces. Oh, well, nobody can describe the way it rolled and tumbled up into the skies, and nobody can half describe the way it smelt. Neither can anybody begin to describe the way that monstrous craft begun to crash along. And such another powwow, thousands of bosun's whistles screaming at once, and a crew like the populations of 100,000 worlds like ours all swearing at once. Well, I never heard the like of it before. We roared and thundered along side by side, both doing our level best, because I'd never struck a comet before that could lay over me, and so I was bound to beat this one or break something. I judged I had some reputation in space, and I calculated to keep it. I noticed I wasn't gaining as fast now as I was before, but still I was gaining. There was a power of excitement on board the comet. Upwards of 100,000,000,000 passengers swarmed up from below and rushed to the side and begun to bet on the race. Of course, this careened her and damaged her speed. My, but wasn't the mate mad? He jumped at that crowd with his trumpet in his hand and sung out, "Amidships! Amidships, you! Blank, or I'll brain the last idiot of you!" Footnote. The captain could not remember what this word was. He said it was in a foreign tongue. Well, sir, I gained and gained, little by little. till at last I went skimming sweetly by the magnificent old conflagration's nose. By this time the captain of the Comet had been rousted out, and he stood there in the red glare forward by the mate, in his shirt sleeves and slippers, his hair all rat's nests, and one suspender hanging, and how sick those two men did look. I just simply couldn't help putting my thumb to my nose as I glided away and singing out, "Ta-ta, ta-ta, any word to send to your family?" Peters, it was a mistake. Yes, sir, I've often regretted that. It was a mistake. You see, the captain had given up the race, but that remark was too tedious for him. He couldn't stand it. He turned to the mate and says he, "Have we got brimstone enough of our own to make the trip?" "Yes, sir." "Sure?" "Yes, sir, more than enough." "How much have we got in cargo for Satan?" 1,800,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, these till the next comet comes. Lighten ship! Lively now! Lively, men! Heave the whole cargo overboard! Peters, look me in the eye and be calm. I found out over there that a Kazark is exactly the bulk of 169 worlds like ours. They hove all that load overboard. When it fell, it wiped out a considerable raft of stars, just as clean as if they'd been candles and somebody blowed them out. As for the race, that was at an end. The minute she was lightened, the comet swung along by me the same as if I was anchored. The captain stood on the stern by the after davits and put his thumb to his nose and sung out, "Ta-ta, ta-ta, maybe you've got some message to send to your friends in the everlasting tropics." Then he hove up his other suspender and started forward, and inside of 3/4 of an hour, his craft was only a pale torch in the distance. Yes, it was a mistake, Peters, that remark of mine. I don't reckon I'll ever get over being sorry about it. I'd have beat the bully of the firmament if I'd kept my mouth shut. But I've wandered a little off the track of my tale. I'll get back on my course again. Now you see what kind of speed I was making. So, as I said, when I had been tearing along this way about 30 years, I begun to get uneasy. Oh, it was pleasant enough, with a good deal to find out, but then it was kind of lonesome, you know. Besides, I wanted to get somewhere. I hadn't shipped with the idea of cruising forever. First off, I liked the delay, because I judged I was going to fetch up in pretty warm quarters when I got through. But towards the last, I begun to feel that I'd rather go to, well, most any place, so as to finish up the uncertainty. Well, one night, it was always night, except when I was rushing by some star that was occupying the whole universe with its fire and its glare. Light enough then, of course, but I necessarily left it behind in a minute or two and plunged into a solid week of darkness again. The stars ain't so close together as they look to be. Where was I? Oh, yes, one night I was sailing along when I discovered a tremendous long row of blinking lights away on the horizon ahead. As I approached, they began to tower and swell and look like mighty furnaces. Says I to myself, "By George, I've arrived at last, and at the wrong place, just as I expected." Then I fainted. I don't know how long I was insensible, but it must have been a good while, for when I came to, the darkness was all gone, and there was the loveliest sunshine and the balmiest, fragrantest air in its place. And there was such a marvelous world spread out before me, such a glowing, beautiful, bewitching country. The things I took for furnaces were gates, miles high, made all of flashing jewels, and they pierced a wall of solid gold that you couldn't see the top of, nor yet the end of, in either direction. I was pointed straight for one of these gates, and a-coming like a house of fire. Now I noticed that the skies were black with millions of people, pointed for those gates. What a roar they made, rushing through the air! The ground was as thick as ants with people, too, billions of them, I judge. I lit. I drifted up to a gate with a swarm of people, and when it was my turn, the head clerk says, in a businesslike way, "Well, quick, where are you from?" "San Francisco," says I. "San Fran what?" says he. "San Francisco." He scratched his head and looked puzzled. Then he says, "Is it a planet?" "By George, Peters, think of it." "Planet?" says I. "It's a city. And moreover, it's one of the biggest and finest, and..." "There, there," says he. "No time here for conversation. We don't deal in cities here. Where are you from in a general way?" "Oh," I says, "I beg your pardon. Put me down for California." I had him again, Peters. He puzzled a second, then he says, sharp and irritable, "I don't know any such planet. Is it a constellation?" "Oh, my goodness," says I. "Constellation," says you? "No, it's a state." "Man, we don't deal in states here. Will you tell me where you are from in general? At large, don't you understand?" "Oh, now I get your idea," I says. "I'm from America, the United States of America." Peters, do you know I had him again? If I hadn't, I'm a clam. His face was as blank as a target after a militia shooting match. He turned to an underclerk and says, "Where is America? What is America?" The underclerk answered up prompt and says, "There ain't any such orb." "Orb?" says I. "What are you talking about, young man? It ain't an orb. It's a country. It's a continent. Columbus discovered it. I reckon likely you've heard of him, anyway. America. Why, sir, America." "Silence," says the head clerk. "Once for all, where are you from?" "Well," says I don't know anything more to say, unless I lump things and just say I'm from the world. "Ah," says he, brightening up, "now that's something like. What world?" Peters, he had me that time. I looked at him, puzzled. He looked at me, worried. Then he burst out, "Come, come, what world?" Says I, "Why, the world, of course." "The world," he says. "There's billions of them. Next." That meant for me to stand aside. I done so, and a sky-blue man with seven heads and only one leg hopped into my place. I took a walk. It just occurred to me then that all the myriads I have seen swarming to that gate up to this time were just like that creature. I tried to run across somebody I was acquainted with, but they were out of acquaintances of mine just then. So I thought the thing all over and finally sidled back there pretty meek and feeling rather stumped, as you may say. "Well?" said the head clerk. "Well, sir," I says, pretty humble, "I don't seem to make out which world it is I'm from, but you may know it from this. It's the one the Savior saved." He bent his head at the name. Then he says gently, "The worlds he has saved are like to the gates of heaven in number. None can count them. What astronomical system is your world in? Perhaps that may assist." "It's the one that has the sun in it, and the moon, and Mars." He shook his head at each name. "Hadn't ever heard of them, you see, and Neptune, and Uranus, and Jupiter." "Hold on," says he. "Hold on a minute. Jupiter. Jupiter. Seems to me we had a man from there 800 or 900 years ago, but people from that system very seldom enter by this gate." All of a sudden, he began to look me so straight in the eye that I thought he was going to bore through me. Then he says, very deliberate, "Did you come straight here from your system?" "Yes, sir," I says, but I blushed the least little bit in the world when I said it. He looked at me very stern and says, "That is not true, and this is not the place for prevarication. You wandered from your course. How did that happen?" Says I, blushing again, "I'm sorry, and I take back what I said and confess. I raced a little with a comet one day, only just the least a little bit, only the tiniest lit so, so," says he, and without any sugar in his voice to speak of. I went on and says, "But I only fell off just a bare point, and I went right back on my course again the minute the race was over." "No matter. That divergence has made all this trouble. It has brought you to a gate that is billions of leagues from the right one. If you had gone to your own gate, they would have known all about your world at once, and there would have been no delay. But we will try to accommodate you." He turned to an underclerk and says, "What system is Jupiter in?" "I don't remember, sir, but I think there is such a planet in one of the little new systems away out in one of the thinly worlded corners of the universe. I will see." He got a balloon and sailed up and up and up in front of a map that was as big as Rhode Island. He went on up till he was out of sight, and by he came down and got something to eat and went up again. To cut a long story short, he kept on doing this for a day or two, and finally he came down and said he thought he had found that solar system, but it might be fly specks. So he got a microscope and went back. It turned out better than he feared. He had rousted out our system, sure enough. He got me to describe our planet and its distance from the sun, and then he says to his chief, "Oh, I know the one he means now, sir. It is on the map. It is called the Wart." Says I to myself, "Young man, it wouldn't be wholesome for you to go down there and call it the Wart." Well, they let me in then and told me I was safe forever and wouldn't have any more trouble. Then they turned from me and went on with their work, the same as if they considered my case all complete and shipshape. I was a good deal surprised at this, but I was diffident about speaking up and reminding them. I did so hate to do it, you know. It seemed a pity to bother them. They had so much on their hands. Twice I thought I would give up and let the thing go, so twice I started to leave. But immediately I thought what a figure I should cut stepping out amongst the redeemed in such a rig, and that made me hang back and come to anchor again. People got to eyeing me, clerks, you know, wondering why I didn't get underway. I couldn't stand this long. It was too uncomfortable. So at last I plucked up courage and tipped the head clerk a signal. He says, "What, you here yet? What's wanting?" Says I in a low and very confidential, making a trumpet with my hands at his ear, "I beg pardon, and you mustn't mind my reminding you and seeming to meddle, but hain't you forgot something?" He studied a second and says, "Forgot something? No, not that I know of." "Think," says I. He thought. Then he says, "No, I can't seem to have forgot anything. What is it?" "Look at me," says I. "Look me all over." He done it. "Well," says he. "Well," says I, "you don't notice anything? If I branched out amongst the elect looking like this, wouldn't I attract considerable attention? Wouldn't I be a little conspicuous?" "Well," he says, "I don't see anything the matter. What do you lack?" "Lack? Why, I lack my harp, and my wreath, and my halo, and my hymn book, and my palm branch. I lack everything that a body naturally requires up here, my friend." Puzzled? Peters, he was the worst puzzled man you ever saw. Finally, he says, "Well, you seem to be a curiosity every way a body takes you. I never heard of these things before." I looked at the man a while in solid astonishment. Then I says, "Now, I hope you don't take it as an offense, for I don't mean any, but really, for a man that has been in the kingdom as long as I reckon you have, you do seem to know powerful little about its customs." "Its customs," says he. "Heaven is a large place, good friend. Large empires have many and diverse customs. Even small dominions have, as you doubtless know by what you have seen of the matter on a small scale in the Wart. How can you imagine I could ever learn the varied customs of the countless kingdoms of heaven? It makes my head ache to think of it. I know the customs that prevail in those portions inhabited by peoples that are appointed to enter by my own gate. And hark ye, that is quite enough knowledge for one individual to try to pack into his head in the 37 millions of years I have devoted night and day to that study. But the idea of learning the customs of the whole appalling expanse of heaven, oh man, how insanely you talk! Now I don't doubt that this odd costume you talk about is the fashion in that district of heaven you belong to, but you won't be conspicuous in this section without it." I felt all right if that was the case, so I bade him good day and left. All day I walked towards the far end of a prodigious hall of the office, hoping to come out into heaven any moment, but it was a mistake. That hall was built on the general heavenly plan. It naturally couldn't be small. At last I got so tired I couldn't go any farther. So I sat down to rest and begun to tackle the queerest sort of strangers and ask for information, but I didn't get any. They couldn't understand my language, and I could not understand theirs. I got dreadfully lonesome. I was so downhearted and homesick, I wished 100 times I never had died. I turned back, of course. About noon next day, I got back at last and was on hand at the booking office once more. Says I to the head clerk, I begin to see that a man's got to be in his own heaven to be happy. Perfectly correct, says he. Did you imagine the same heaven would suit all sorts of men? Well, I had that idea, but I see the foolishness of it. Which way am I to go to get to my district? He called the underclerk that had examined the map, and he gave me general directions. I thanked him and started, but he says, Wait a minute. It is millions of leagues from here. Go outside and stand on that red wishing carpet. Shut your eyes, hold your breath, and wish yourself there. I'm much obliged, says I. Why didn't you dart me through when I first arrived? We have a good deal to think of here. It was your place to think of it and ask for it. Goodbye. We probably shan't see you in this region for 1,000 centuries or so. In that case, au revoir, says I. I hopped onto the carpet and held my breath and shut my eyes and wished I was in the booking office of my own section. The very next instant, a voice I knew sung out in a business kind of way. A harp and a hymn book, pair of wings and a halo, size 13 for Cap'n Eli Stormfield of San Francisco. Make him out a clean bill of health and let him in. I opened my eyes. Sure enough, it was a Piute engine I used to know in Tulare County. Mighty good fellow. I remembered being at his funeral, which consisted of him being burnt and the other engines gauming their faces with his ashes and howling like wildcats. He was powerful glad to see me, and you may make up your mind I was just as glad to see him and feel that I was in the right kind of heaven at last. Just as far as your eye could reach, there were swarms of clerks running and bustling around, tricking out thousands of Yanks and Mexicans and English and Arabs and all sorts of people in their new outfits. And when they gave me my kit, and I put on my halo, and took a look in the glass, I could have jumped over a house for joy. I was so happy. Now this is something like, says I. Now, says I, I'm all right. Show me a cloud. Inside of 15 minutes, I was a mile on my way towards the cloud banks, and about 1,000,000 people along with me. Most of us tried to fly, but some got crippled, and nobody made a success of it. So we concluded to walk, for the present, till we had some wing practice. We began to meet swarms of folks who were coming back. Some had harps and nothing else. Some had hymn books and nothing else. Some had nothing at all. All of them looked meek and uncomfortable. One young fellow hadn't anything left but his halo, and he was carrying that in his hand. All of a sudden he offered it to me and says, Will you hold it for me for a minute? Then he disappeared in the crowd. I went on. A woman asked me to hold her palm branch, and then she disappeared. A girl got me to hold her harp for her, and by George, she disappeared, and so on, till I was about loaded down to the guards. Then comes a smiling old gentleman and asked me to hold his things. I swabbed off the perspiration and says, pretty tart, I'll have to get you to excuse me, my friend. I ain't no hat rack. About this time, I began to run across piles of those traps lying in the road. I just quietly dumped my extra cargo along with them. I looked around, and Peters, that whole nation that was following me, were loaded down the same as I'd been. The return crowd had got them to hold their things a minute, you see. They all dumped their loads, too, and we went on. When I found myself perched on a cloud with 1,000,000 other people, I never felt so good in my life. Says I, now this is according to the promises. I've been having my doubts, but now I am in heaven sure enough. I gave my palm branch a wave or two for luck, and then I tautened up my harp strings and struck in. Well, Peters, you can't imagine anything like the row we made. It was grand to listen to, and made a body thrill all over, but there was considerable many tunes going on at once, and that was a drawback to the harmony, you understand. And then there was a lot of engine tribes, and they kept up such another war whooping that they kind of took the tuck out of the music. By and by, I quit performing and judged I'd take a rest. There was quite a nice, mild old gentleman sitting next to me, and I noticed he didn't take a hand. I encouraged him, but he said he was naturally bashful and was afraid to try before so many people. By and by, the old gentleman said he never could seem to enjoy music somehow. The fact was, I was beginning to feel the same way, but I didn't say anything. Him and I had a considerable long silence then, but of course it weren't noticeable in that place. After about 16 or 17 hours, during which I played and sung a little, now and then, always the same tune, because I didn't know any other, I laid down my harp and begun to fan myself with my palm branch. Then we both got to sighing pretty regular. Finally, says he, "Don't you know any tune but the one you've been pegging at all day?" "Not another blessed one," says I. "Don't you reckon you could learn another one?" says he. "Never," says I. "I've tried to, but I couldn't manage it." "It's a long time to hang to the one. Eternity, you know." "Don't break my heart," says I. "I'm getting low-spirited enough already." After another long silence, says he, "Are you glad to be here?" Says I, "Old man, I'll be frank with you. This ain't just as near my idea of bliss as I thought it was going to be when I used to go to church." Says he, "What do you say to knocking off and calling it half a day?" "That's me," says I. "I never wanted to get off watch so bad in my life." So we started. Millions were coming to the cloud bank all the time, happy and hosannaing. Millions were leaving it all the time, looking mighty quiet, I tell you. We laid for the newcomers, and pretty soon I'd got them to hold all my things a minute, and then I was a free man again and most outrageously happy. Just then I ran across old Sam Bartlett, who had been dead a long time, and stopped to have a talk with him. Says I, "Now tell me, is this to go on forever? Ain't there anything else for a change?" Says he, "I'll set you right on that point very quick. People take the figurative language of the Bible and the allegories for literal, and the first thing they ask for when they get here is a halo and a harp, and so on. Nothing that's harmless and reasonable is refused a body here, if he asks it in the right spirit. So they are outfitted with these things without a word. They go and sing and play just about one day, and that's the last you'll ever see them in the choir. They don't need anybody to tell them that that sort of thing wouldn't make a heaven, at least not a heaven that a sane man could stand a week and remain sane. That cloud bank is placed where the noise can't disturb the old inhabitants, and so there ain't any harm in letting everybody get up there and cure himself as soon as he comes. Now you just remember this, heaven is as blissful and lovely as it can be, but it's just the busiest place you ever heard of. There ain't any idle people here after the first day. Singing hymns and waving palm branches through all eternity is pretty when you hear about it in the pulpit, but it's as poor a way to put in valuable time as a body could contrive. It would just make a heaven of warbling ignoramuses, don't you see? Eternal rest sounds comforting in the pulpit, too. Well, you try it once and see how heavy time will hang on your hands. Why, Stormfield, a man like you, that had been active and stirring all his life, would go mad in 6 months in a heaven where he hadn't anything to do. Heaven is the very last place to come to rest in, and don't you be afraid to bet on that. Says I, "Sam, I'm as glad to hear it as I thought I'd be sorry. I'm glad I come now." Says he, "Cap'n, ain't you pretty physically tired?" Says I, "Sam, it ain't any name for it. I'm dog tired." "Just so, just so. You've earned a good sleep, and you'll get it. You've earned a good appetite, and you'll enjoy your dinner. It's the same here as it is on earth. You've got to earn a thing square and honest before you enjoy it. You can't enjoy first and earn afterwards. But there's this difference here. You can choose your own occupation, and all the powers of heaven will be put forth to help you make a success of it, if you do your level best. The shoemaker on earth that had the soul of a poet in him won't have to make shoes here." "Now that's all reasonable and right," says I. "Plenty of work, and the kind you hanker after. No more pain, no more suffering. Oh, hold on, there's plenty of pain here, but it don't kill. There's plenty of suffering here, but it don't last. You see, happiness ain't a thing in itself. It's only a contrast with something that ain't pleasant. That's all it is. There ain't a thing you can mention that is happiness in its own self. It's only so by contrast with the other thing. And so, as soon as the novelty is over and the force of the contrast dulled, it ain't happiness any longer, and you have to get something fresh. Well, there's plenty of pain and suffering in heaven, Consequently, there's plenty of contrasts, and just no end of happiness. Says I, "It's the sensiblest heaven I've heard of yet, Sam, though it's about as different from the one I was brought up on as a live princess is different from her own wax figure." Along in the first months, I knocked around about the kingdom, making friends and looking at the country, and finally settled down in a pretty likely region to have a rest before taking another start. I went on making acquaintances and gathering up information. I had a good deal of talk with an old bald-headed angel by the name of Sandy McWilliams. He was from somewhere in New Jersey. I went about with him considerable. We used to lay around warm afternoons in the shade of a rock, on some meadow ground that was pretty high, and out of the marshy slush of his cranberry farm, and there we used to talk about all kinds of things and smoke pipes. "One day," says I, "about how old might you be, Sandy?" 72. "I judged so. How long you been in heaven?" 27 years come Christmas. "How old was you when you come up?" "Why, 72, of course."
"You can't mean it."
"Why can't I mean it?" "Because if you was 72 then you are naturally 99 now." "No, but I ain't. I stay the same age I was when I come." "Well," says I, "come to think, there's something just here that I want to ask about. Down below, I always had an idea that in heaven we would all be young and bright and spry."
"Well, you can be young if you want to. You've only got to wish."
"Well, then why didn't you wish?"
"I did. They all do. You'll try it some day, like enough, but you'll get tired of the change pretty soon."
"Why?"
"Well, I'll tell you. Now you've always been a sailor. Did you ever try some other business?"
"Yes, I tried keeping grocery once, up in the mines, but I couldn't stand it. It was too dull. No stir, no storm, no life about it. It was like being part dead and part alive, both at the same time. I wanted to be one thing or t'other. I shut up shop pretty quick and went to sea."
"That's it. Grocery people like it, but you couldn't. You see, you wasn't used to it."
"Well, I wasn't used to being young, and I couldn't seem to take any interest in it. I was strong and handsome, and had curly hair, yes, and wings too, gay wings like a butterfly. I went to picnics and dances and parties with the fellows, and tried to carry on and talk nonsense with the girls, but it wasn't any use. I couldn't take to it. Fact is, it was an awful bore. What I wanted was early to bed and early to rise and something to do, and when my work was done, I wanted to sit quiet and smoke and think, not tear around with a parcel of giddy young kids. You can't think what I suffered whilst I was young."
"How long was you young?"
"Only 2 weeks. That was plenty for me. Laws, I was so lonesome. You see, I was full of the knowledge and experience of 72 years. The deepest subject those young folks could strike was only ABC to me. And to hear them argue, oh my, it would have been funny if it hadn't been so pitiful. Well, I was so hungry for the ways and the sober talk I was used to that I tried to ring in with the old people, but they wouldn't have it. They considered me a conceited young upstart and gave me the cold shoulder. 2 weeks was aplenty for me. I was glad to get back my bald head again, and my pipe, and my old drowsy reflections in the shade of a rock or a tree."
"Well," says I, "do you mean to say you're going to stand still at 72 forever?"
"I don't know, and I ain't particular. But I ain't going to drop back to 25 anymore. I know that mighty well. I know a sight more than I did 27 years ago, and I enjoy learning all the time, but I don't seem to get any older. That is, bodily. My mind gets older, and stronger, and better seasoned, and more satisfactory." Says I, "If a man comes here at 90, don't he ever set himself back?"
"Of course he does. He sets himself back to 14, tries it a couple of hours, and feels like a fool. Sets himself forward to 20, it ain't much improvement, tries 30, 50, 80, and finally 90, finds he is more at home and comfortable at the same old figure he is used to than any other way. Or, if his mind begun to fail him on earth at 80, that's where he finally sticks up here. He sticks up at the place where his mind was last at its best, for there's where his enjoyment is best and his ways most set and established. Does a chap of 25 always stay 25 and look it? If he is a fool, yes. But if he is bright and ambitious and industrious, the knowledge he gains and the experience he has change his ways and thoughts and likings, and make him find his best pleasure in the company of people above that age, so he allows his body to take on that look of as many added years as he needs to make him comfortable and proper in that sort of society. He lets his body go on taking the look of age according as he progresses, and by he will be bald and wrinkled outside and wise and deep within. Babies the same? Babies the same. Laws, what asses we used to be on earth about these things. We said we'd always be young in heaven. We didn't say how young. We didn't think of that, perhaps. That is, we didn't all think alike, anyway. When I was a boy of 7, I suppose I thought we'd all be 12 in heaven. When I was 12, I suppose I thought we'd all be 18 or 20 in heaven. When I was 40, I begun to go back. I remember I hoped we'd all be about 30 years old in heaven. Neither a man nor a boy ever thinks the age he has is exactly the best one. He puts the right age a few years older or a few years younger than he is. Then he makes that ideal age the general age of the heavenly people, and he expects everybody to stick at that age, stand stock still, and expects them to enjoy it. Now just think of the idea of standing still in heaven. Think of a heaven made up entirely of hoop-rolling, marble-playing cubs of 7 years, or of awkward, diffident, sentimental immaturities of 19, or of vigorous people of 30, healthy-minded, brimming with ambition, but chained hand and foot to that one age, and its limitations like so many helpless galley slaves. Think of the dull sameness of a society made up of people all of one age and one set of looks, habits, tastes, and feelings. Think how superior to it Earth would be, with its variety of types and faces and ages, and the enlivening attrition of the myriad interests that come into pleasant collision in such a variegated society. Look here, says I, do you know what you're doing? Well, what am I doing? You are making heaven pretty comfortable in one way, but you are playing the mischief with it in another. How do you mean? Well, says I, take a young mother that's lost her child and, shh, he says, look. It was a woman, middle-aged, and had grizzled hair. She was walking slow, and her head was bent down, and her wings hanging limp and droopy. And she looked ever so tired, and was crying, poor thing. She passed along by with her head down that way, and the tears running down her face, and didn't see us. Then Sandy said, low and gentle and full of pity, she's hunting for her child. No, found it, I reckon. Lord, how she's changed! But I recognized her in a minute, though it's 27 years since I saw her. A young mother she was, about 22 or 24 or along there, and blooming and lovely and sweet, oh, just a flower. And all her heart and all her soul was wrapped up in her child, her little girl, 2 years old. And it died, and she went wild with grief, just wild. Well, the only comfort she had was that she'd see her child again in heaven, never more to part, she said, and kept on saying it over and over, never more to part. And the words made her happy. Yes, they did. They made her joyful. And when I was dying 27 years ago, she told me to find her child the first thing, and say she was coming. Soon, soon, very soon, she hoped and believed. Why, it's pitiful, Sandy. He didn't say anything for a while, but sat looking at the ground, thinking. Then he says, kind of mournful, and now she's come. Well, go on. Stormfield, maybe she hasn't found the child, but I think she has. Looks so to me. I've seen cases before. You see, she's kept that child in her head just the same as it was when she jounced it in her arms, a little chubby thing. But here it didn't elect to stay a child. No, it elected to grow up, which it did. And in these 27 years it has learned all the deep scientific learning there is to learn, and is studying and studying and learning more and more all the time, and don't give a damn for anything but learning, just learning, and discussing gigantic problems with people like herself. Well, Stormfield, don't you see? Her mother knows cranberries and how to tend them, and pick them and put them up and market them, and not another blamed thing. Her and her daughter can't be any more company for each other now than Mud Turtle and Bird of Paradise. Poor thing, she was looking for a baby to jounce. I think she's struck a disappointment. Sandy, what will they do? Staying happy forever in heaven? No, they'll come together and get adjusted by and by, but not this year and not next. By and by. End of chapter 1.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a second piece of Twain for you. This is episode 1 of Adam's Diary from the Diary of Adam and Eve.
This new creature with the long hair is a good deal in the way. It always hanging around and following me about. I don't like this. I'm not used to company. I wish it would stay with the other animals. It's cloudy today. Wind in the east. I think we shall have rain. We? Where did I get that word? Oh, yeah. The new creature uses it. Tuesday. Been examining the great waterfall. It's the finest thing on the estate, I think. The new creature calls it Niagara Falls. Why, I'm sure I don't know. Says it looks like Niagara Falls. That's not a reason, it's a mere waywardness and imbecility. I get no chance to name anything myself. The new creature names everything that comes along before I can get in a protest. And always that same pretext is offered. It looks like the thing. Now there's a dodo, for example. Says the moment one looks at it, one sees a glance that looks like a dodo. It will have to keep that name, no doubt. It wearies me to fret about it and does no good anyway. Dodo. Looks no more like a dodo than I do. Wednesday. Built me a shelter against the rain, but could not have it to myself in peace. The new creature intruded. When I tried to put it out, it shed water out of those holes it looks with and wiped it away with the back of its paw and made a noise such as some of the other animals make when they're in distress. I wish it wouldn't talk. It's always talking. It sounds like a cheap fling at the poor creature, a slur, but I don't mean it if so. I've never heard the human voice before, any new and strange sound intruding itself upon the solemn hush of these dreaming solitudes offends my ear and seems a false note. And this new sound is so close to me, it's right at my shoulder, right at my ear, first on one side, then on the other, and I'm used to only the sounds that are more or less distant from me. Friday, the naming goes on recklessly, in spite of anything I can do. I had a very good name for the estate, and it was musical and pretty, Garden of Eden. Privately, I continue to call it that, but not any longer publicly. The new creature says it's all woods and rocks and scenery, and therefore has no resemblance to a garden. Says it looks like a park, and it doesn't look like anything but a park. Consequently, without consulting me, it has been renamed Niagara Falls Park. This is sufficiently high-handed, it seems to me, and there's already a sign-up. Keep off the grass. My life is not as happy as it was. Saturday. The new creature eats too much fruit. We're going to run short, most likely we, again. And it's its word, mine too now, from hearing it so much. Good deal of fog this morning. I do not go out into the fog myself. This new creature does. It goes out in all weather and stumps right in with its muddy feet and talks. It used to be so pleasant and quiet here. Sunday. Pull through. The day is getting to be more and more trying. It was selected and set apart last November as a day of rest. I had already 6 of them per week before. The morning found the new creature trying to claw apples out of that forbidden tree. Monday. The new creature says its name is Eve. That's all right. I have no objection. Says it is to call it by when I want it to come. I said it was superfluous then. The word evidently raised me in its respect. And indeed, it is a large and good word and will bear repetition. It says it, not an it, it's a she. This is probably doubtful, yet it's all one to me. What she is were nothing to me if she would just go by herself and not talk. Tuesday. She has littered the whole estate with irascible names and offensive signs. This way to the whirlpool. This way to Goat Island. Cave of the Winds, this way. She says this park would make a tidy summer resort if there was any custom for it. Summer resort. Another invention of hers. Just words, without any meaning. What's a summer resort? But it's best not to ask her. She has such a rage for explaining. Friday. She has taken to beseeching me to stop going over the falls. What harm's it do? Says it makes it shudder. I wonder why. I've always done it. I always liked the plunge and the coolness. I suppose it was what the falls were for. They have no other use that I can see. And they must have been made for something. She says they were only made for scenery, like the rhinoceros and the mastodon. I went over the falls in a barrel. Not satisfactory to her. Went over in a tub. Still not satisfactory. Swam the whirlpool and the rapids in a fig leaf suit. It got much damaged, hence tedious complaints about my extravagance. I am too much hampered here. What I need is a change of scene. Saturday. I escaped last Tuesday. Traveled 2 days. Built me another shelter in a secluded place. Obliterated my tracks as well as I could, but she hunted me out by means of a beast which she has named and calls a wolf. And she came, making that pitiful noise again and shedding that water out of the places she looks with. I was obliged to return with her, but will presently emigrate again when the occasion offers. She engaged herself in many foolish things, among others, to study out why the animals called lions and tigers live on grass and flowers when, as she says, that sort of teeth they wear would indicate they were intended to eat each other. This is foolish, because to do that would be to kill each other, and that would introduce what, as I understand, is called death. And death, as I've been told, has not yet entered the park, which is a pity, on some accounts. Sunday. Pull through. Monday. I believe I see what a week is for. It's to give time to rest up from the weariness of Sunday. It seems a good idea. She's been climbing that tree again, clotted her out of it. She said nobody was looking. Seems to consider that a sufficient justification for chancing any dangerous thing. Told her that the word justification moved her admiration and envy too. I thought, it's a good word. Tuesday. She told me she was made out of a rib taken from my body. This is at least doubtful, if not more than that. I've not missed any rib. She is in much trouble about the buzzard. Says the grass does not agree with it. Is afraid she can't raise it. Thinks it was intended to live on decayed flesh. The buzzard must get along as best it can with what's provided. We cannot overturn the whole scheme to accommodate the buzzard. Saturday. She fell in the pond yesterday. And when she was looking at it herself, which she's always doing, she nearly strangled and said it was most uncomfortable. This made her sorry for the creatures which live in there, which she calls fish. For she continues to fasten names onto things that don't need them, and don't come when they're called by them, which is a matter of no consequence to her. She is such a numbskull. Anyway, so she got all out of them and brought them in last night and put them in my bed to keep warm. But I've noticed now and then, all day, and I don't see they are any happier than they were before, only quieter. When night comes, I shall throw them outdoors. I will not sleep with them again, for I find them clammy and unpleasant to lie among when a person hasn't anything on. Sunday. Pull through. Tuesday. She's taken up with a snake now. The other animals are glad, for she's always experimenting with them and bothering them, and I'm glad because the snake talks, and this enables me to get some rest. Friday. She says the snake advises her to try the fruit of the tree, and says the result will be great and fine and noble education. I told her there would be another result. It would introduce death into the world, and that was a mistake. It's been better to keep my remarks to myself. It only gave her an idea. She could save the sick buzzard and furnish fresh meat to the despondent lions and tigers. I advised her to keep away from the tree. She said she wouldn't. I foresee trouble. I will emigrate. Wednesday. I have had a variegated time. I escaped last night and rode a horse all night as fast as he could go, hoping to get clear of the park and hide in some other country before trouble should begin. But it was not to be. About an hour after sunup, as I was riding through a flowery plain where thousands of animals were grazing, slumbering, or playing with each other according to their wont, all of a sudden they broke into a tempest of a frightful noise, and one moment the plain was a frantic commotion, and every beast was destroying its neighbor. I knew what that meant. Eve had eaten that fruit, and the death had come into the world. The tigers ate my house, paying no attention to when I ordered them to desist. They would have eaten me, too, if I'd stayed, which I didn't, but went away in much haste. I found this place outside the park and was fairly comfortable for a few days, but she's found me out. Found me out, and she's named the place Tonawanda. Says it looks like that. In fact, I was not sorry she came, for there was but meager pickings here, and she brought some of those apples. I was obliged to eat them, for I was hungry. It was against my principles, but I find the principles have no real force except when one is well fed. She came curtained in boughs and bunches of leaves, and when I asked her what she meant by such nonsense and snatched them away and threw them down, she tittered and blushed. I'd never seen a person titter and blush before, and to me it seemed unbecoming and idiotic. She said I would soon know how it was myself. This was correct. Hungry as I was, I laid down the apple half-eaten, certainly the best one I ever had, considering the lateness of the season, and arrayed myself in the discarded boughs and branches, and then spoke to her with some severity and ordered her to go and get some more and not make a spectacle of herself. She did it, and after this we crept down to where the wild beast battle had been and collected some skins, and I made her a patch together of a couple of suits proper for a public occasion. They're uncomfortable, it's true, but stylish, and that's the main point about clothes. I find she's a great deal of a companion. I see I should be lonesome and depressed without her, now that I've lost my property. Another thing, she says, it's ordered that we work for our living hereafter. She'll be useful. I will superintend. 10 days later, she accuses me of being the cause of our disaster. She says with apparent sincerity and truth that the serpent assured her that the forbidden fruit was not apples, it was chestnuts. And I said I was innocent then, for I had not eaten any chestnuts. And she said the serpent informed her that the chestnut was a figurative term meaning an aged and moldy joke. I turned pale at that, for I have made many jokes to pass the weary time, and some of them could have been that sort, although I had honestly supposed that they were new when I made them. She asked me if I made one just at the time of the catastrophe. I was obliged to admit that I had made one to myself, though not aloud. It was this. I was thinking about the falls, and I said to myself, how wonderful to see that vast body of water tumble down there. Then, in an instant, a bright thought flashed into my head, and I let it fly, saying, it would be a great deal more wonderful to see it tumble up there. And I was just about to kill myself with laughing when all nature broke loose in war and death, and I had to flee for my life. There, she said with triumph, that is just it. The serpent mentioned that very jest and called it the first chestnut and said it was coeval with creation. Alas, I am indeed to blame. Would I were not witty, that I had never had that radiant thought. Next year, we have named it Cain. She caught it while I was up country trapping in the North Shore. Caught it in a timber a couple miles from our dugout, or what might have been four, she isn't sure. It resembled us in some ways and may be a relation. That's what she thinks, but this is an error in my judgment. The difference in size warrants the conclusion, but it's a different sort and a new kind of animal, a fish perhaps. Though when I put it in water to see, it sank, and she plunged in and snatched it out before there was an opportunity for the experiment to determine the matter. I still think it's a fish, but she's indifferent about what it is and will not let me have it to try. I do not understand this. The coming of the creature seems to have changed her whole nature and made her unreasonable about experiments. She thinks more of it than she does of any of the other animals, but is not able to explain why. Her mind is disordered. Everything shows. Sometimes she carries the fish in her arms half the night when it complains and wants to get to the water. And it's sometimes the water comes out of places in her face and she looks out and she pats the fish on the back and makes soft sounds with her mouth to soothe it and betrays sorrow and solicitude in 100 ways. I have never seen her like this any other fish, and it troubles me greatly. She used to carry around the young tigers and play with them before we lost our property. But that was only play. She never took on about them like this when their dinner disagreed with them. Sunday. She doesn't work Sundays, but lies around all tired out and likes to have the fish wallow over her. She makes fool noises to amuse it and pretends to chew its paws, and that makes it laugh. I've not seen a fish before that could laugh. This makes me doubt. Now, I have come like this to like Sundays myself. Superintending all week tires a body out, so there ought to be more Sundays. In the old days, they were tough, but now they come handy. Wednesday. It isn't a fish. I can make out what it is. It makes curious, devilish noises when it's not satisfied. It says, goo, goo, what it is. It's not one of us, for it doesn't walk. It's not a bird, for it doesn't fly. It's not a frog, for it doesn't hop. It's not a snake, for it doesn't crawl. I feel sure it's not a fish, though. I cannot get a chance to find out whether it can swim or not. It merely lies around, mostly on its back, with its feet up. I have not seen any other animal do that before. I said, I believe it was an enigma, but she only admired the word without understanding it. In my judgment, it's either an enigma or some kind of bug. If it dies, I'll take it apart and see what its arrangements are. Never had a thing perplex me so.
And that was part one of the Diary of Adam and Eve. And all we are saying is goodnight, my friends. We'll see you next week when the Florida Media Lab's Comedy Playhouse is back on the air. Goodnight.